Radio, and here we go, another episode of We Talk Music on the air and in your ear. I'm Mo, and this is Brett, and who cares, because we have Brian Ball over here. And that's what really counts.
We're nice to be here, guys.
Going to get right to it, because you got a new album coming out, Helix, the old school.
It's already out.
It's already out.
That's right. It is already out.
Okay, so it dropped on Friday, right?
Pardon?
It dropped on the 6th, didn't it?
Well, you know, they used to have official release dates for albums, but nowadays, it's whatever you get it back from the pressing plant, that's what she goes out the door. So,
yeah, because I know you've got...
Because I think that Paris Records is putting it out in June sometime.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, because nowadays, and especially with you moving, I mean, you've got to be super busy.
Oh, it's freaking crazy over the last month because we had, you know, Linda and I lived there for 28 years. So I got memorabilia, I got posters, I got tour jackets, I got all sorts of... stuff. I'm a pat rack, so I saved everything. Plus, we had tons of antiques and just all sorts of stuff in that house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to old school.
Because, that's right.
You know, I'm pretty curious about this because I know, you know, you found these tapes, you know, these are songs from 81 to 89.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, yeah, what's the difference between this and the B-side rarity album that you kind of released before?
Well, they're different songs for one thing, but I think that these songs are probably a higher quality than that album, but you know, that's all up to the listener. But a lot of these songs are really good songs, we just never released for whatever reason back in the day. Each of them had their different reason why they didn't come out, but I think it's a really strong album. It's somebody said it sounds like the follow-up to Back for Another Case.
Okay, great. Well,
yeah, because I know that a lot of the songs were from, the, or three of the songs were from that recording session, I guess.
Three of the songs were from that recording session, and a lot of other songs were written for that album, like Whiskey, Bet, and Hellbound, Coming Back with Bigger Guns, Closer to You, Cheers.
Yeah, I was listening to Southern Comfort, and that was the one that that you had a lick from Paul, was it? And then you turned it into
I don't even
song.
Know where I found the lick. I think it's Paul's lick. I'm pretty sure it's Paul's lick, right? And one night I just put the lyrics to it, and that was the tenth song.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of like the, just the, those recordings still sitting around that
tons.
You, yeah. And do you always look forward to kind of going through them, but it's just a lack of time, really?
Well, it's a lack of time. That's one of the reasons I sold the house, you know. Things that you accumulate over time have a tendency of overtaking your life because you got to take care of your things, you got to insure your things, you got to clean your things, you got to store your things, you know what I mean? So we're downsizing now. It's going to give you a lot more time to go through the tapes. Plus Rob Bursey from Metal Rules out in Newfoundland said he wants to sort through them and help me. And the films especially because they go right back to the 70s. And I was one of the few people in Canada that actually took pictures of the when we were out playing the bars, like the Manor and Kingston, the Coronet, Kitchener, Engine Shed, the airliner in Calgary. So I'm going to put together those films and take some time to work on them.
Yeah, so it's almost like you're a bit of a like a hard rock archivist then, I guess, when it comes down to it.
Well, I just never threw anything away. I saved everything, and I shouldn't say I saved everything because there was a lot I gave away too, just to fans and people like that over the years. But I did retain a lot of it, and the University of Toronto is actually going to, I've donated a lot to them, and they're going to catalog it all and store it and then give me a tax receipt for the stuff I give to them. Person that turned me on to that was Greg Grodovich, and Greg's an old friend of mine, and he's done the same thing. But Helix, you know, was the first metal band ever to come out of Canada, really. And so I think we have our place in Canadian music history. So all this stuff is valuable to those people that actually keep the historical content and catalog it all and do all that type of thing.
No, and I can say, you know, from our perspective, I mean, it would be amazing to see this stuff. Because, yeah, like, as fans, I know that we've been following you for decades. And the idea of, with any of the bands that we're big fans of, the idea of being able to kind of go back and see a lot of that that history is really awesome. Because in some cases, we weren't able to be there. Or in most cases, we weren't able to be there. But
well, one of the coolest things I gave the University of Toronto was when my... grandmother died, and when my mother and father moved, and then my dad died, they gave me back all the letters and postcards I wrote to them over the years, and they're like a snapshot of that time period. That I was looking at them and going, wow, here's one I wrote from Spain when we were on tour with Kiss, and here's another one when we were playing the bars in Western Canada, and, you know, I got just a little note, and today I did this, or so. They're pretty cool from that perspective. It gives you an idea into the lifestyle, because nowadays bands don't do that. They don't tour across the country through bars, which is a shame. And then there's other things like the tour jackets and just the records themselves. I have a whole slew of them. And
you know, it actually brings up something, because Geddy Lee's on tour, going to different places, you know, with his collection of basses, really, mm-hmm. and guitars, and you know, and it's like an autograph signing session and photograph, and he's showing these things and giving a speech, and it sounds to me like this is something that, I mean, I wish I, you know, I would think there'd be a market for it. I know me and Brett would be interested, mm-hmm. if you could take something like that, some of this memorabilia on the road, and interact with the fans. Is that something you've ever thought about?
Well, I got more projects than I got time to do them, so that's way down the list.
So yeah, I guess when you're working on a project like so, I mean, obviously personal projects kind of would come first, but like, so it's Helix, the band, and then you play, like right now you actually have a pretty busy summer coming up from what I can see.
A pretty big busy summer touring, plus we're moving into a new house, so you don't get to work on it. We're working on the next Helix album already. It's just going to be written by the lineup I have in the band now. And of course there's the films and... Jeez, believe me, there's always a project.
Yeah, because I was just wondering, like, how you kind of figure out which ones to triage and do first.
Well, I just take them in order of priority. One of the other things I want to do is put together videos about the bel canto technique of singing, which I teach. I'm one of the last people in the world to teach you bel canto, totally by accident. The guy that taught me was a man named Edward Johnson. He was the youngest member of the New York Metropolitan Opera. He sang for Norman Vincent Peale, was a soloist out of New York City. Norman Vincent Peale wrote The Power of Positive Thinking, which was the first ever self-help book that every other self-help book has been modeled after. It was originally called The Power of Faith, but they thought it was too religious of a title, and so they got him to change it to The Power of Positive Thinking. Ed also sang with the great soprano Beverly Sills, one of the few Canadians to sing at all three major U.S. opera houses, including Carnegie Hall. He taught me, Andy Kern of Coney Hatch, Gilmour of Triumph, Daniel Lanois, Beverly D'Angelo. He taught Major Hoople's Boarding House, Copper Penny, all, like just everybody that was on the circuit back in the 70s, because back then, because bands were playing 3 to 5 sets a night, 7 nights a week, they were all losing their voices. And bel canto, which is the original method that everybody used to sing with, which is an Italian technique, by the way, and it means beautiful voice. It's the only way to sing without having tension on the vocal cords. Now, when I sing and I'm singing rock, it's never going to quite be without tension, because rock is a distorted sound as opposed to classical music, which is only pure vowel sounds. So, you know, you're going to have a bit of tension, but it allows me to sing night after night and not lose my voice. And you know, a lot of other singers my age are suffering from the consequences of singing for so many years and singing that raunchy rock and roll.
Well, it actually brings up, because Get Your Dance Hands Dirty was a, you know, a different sound. Yes. You get a chance to explore something different and use your voice in a different way. Is that mm-hmm. was that kind of the appeal of that one?
Well, I always want to do some of those songs, and can't remember what the original spark was for that, but the opportunity came up, and I got a chance to work with Gavin Brown, who has run numerous Junos, Grammy, and some fantastic musicians, and so I went for it, and that album came out. Didn't really sell that well, but I'm always under the auspice that if you put out quality stuff over time, it eventually sells. My book, which I put out way back when, I can't even remember what it was, probably the early 90s. I remember when I put out my book, I bought 2,000 units, and I think it cost me $16,000. I couldn't get anybody to distribute it for me. to give me a decent deal. That, screw it, I'll do it myself. Well, I started off selling those books at $30 each, then I dropped it to $20, and then it went back up. Anyway, over the course of time, I probably made $40,000 off that book. So everything I do is a long-term project because that's the way it sells. It's not like when we were with Capitol Records, for instance, and once again, we have that release date and it comes out through the gate and, you know, they're pushing it the first week in radio and trying to drive it up on Billboard and stuff like that. Nowadays, you know, you put out a record and you just try to sell as much as you can, but it's something that, you know, you have to be prepared to sell over quite a few years. And, you know, it just trickles out a little bit here, a little bit there, and it all adds up. And as long as I can keep doing this and not lose money, because obviously I have to pay my bills, I can continue doing it. And, you know, I love what I do. I tell people I don't really have a job. I have the world's most expensive hobbies. So.
Yeah, because we know a lot of guys that are in the that are singers and in the music industry, and a lot of them do have to have a day job, and so it's mm-hmm. always interesting to see. And I think that's something you can kind of get from you is that starting lots of projects and being able to push through so that by the time one is over, then maybe you're seeing money from another one down the line, like that's.
Well, it all trickles in. The real money nowadays is in live performance. Mm-hmm. You know, records are really a vanity project. You don't really make money off of records. If I can break even, I think that's a triumph. But most of my records do make money for me. Once again, over a long period of time. And the reason I got into music in the first place is to write music and write songs. I still get the biggest charge out of writing songs and recording songs. So as long as I can keep doing it and not go broke, I'm going to keep doing it. But really, you know, if you're in this business to make money, releasing original music is not the way to go.
Well, you said before, they don't want to play the songs, the new songs from classic bands. They want to play the old songs from the classic bands. They don't want to give the new ones a try.
That's right. The CRTC ratings actually work against bands, the Canadian content ruling, because you have a classic rock station in Edmonton, say the Bear, right? And what happens is they have to pay, what is it, 20% Canadian content, something like that. Yeah. So, you know, they're looking at the new Trooper song and they're looking at Here for a Good Time. Well, one's a proven hit, right? And one is an unknown, right? And a lot of times older people, people my age I'm talking about, will not, they don't still listen to new music, right? Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But as for the station, Brent Derner, he used to be in the band The Doctor, used to make fun of the radio station. He'd say, he'd pretend he was like from the radio station, say, we don't make the hits, we just play them. Yeah. Which kind of sums it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what about live then? Is that the best place then to introduce these new songs? Because, I mean, you also got to balance that with giving the fans what they want, right, too.
When we go out and we do our show, we always play the hits. That's what they're there to hear, right? So we give them what they want. And then we work in some new stuff because we think that's what they want to hear, too. They want to hear, you know, if they're really into the band, and I know our fans are because I talk to them. We take time going out after the show, and we actually converse with our fans, take pictures with them, shake hands. And we talk about the new music, and then they'll tell you what they like and what they don't like. And some of the songs that have become staples in the set, like Even Jesus Wasn't Loved in His Hometown, The Devil's Having a Party Tonight. But then there's been other ones we put on stage where, you know, didn't really get feedback from the audience. So we dropped them. We went, you know, put them on for a while and then we take them off. But we're always kind of changing up the show because, A, we don't want the fans to get bored. And B, we don't want to get bored either. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing worse than seeing a band up there going through the motions, right? And there are a lot of bands out there like that.
Yeah, no doubt.
Last time you were in town, Danger Zone was a song that you played in your set as an example for us. Mm-hmm. We both walked away going, we heard that before, but we didn't realize how good it was till we heard it live.
And now it's in great attention for us.
Yeah. And if a song can carry itself live, then you know you got a good song.
Yeah.
Because people are only hearing it like that. Mm-hmm. Usually people, you know, they're coming out once again to hear the hits. So it's a song they've heard over and over and over again. So when you can play a song and on one listen have people like the song, that's usually an indication you got a good song.
Yeah, because it's interesting to think about the last time you were in Calgary was a year ago, and now you're back. And so, like, obviously you have to tour, but how do you change the set then for another trip to Calgary or another trip to the same city?
Well, tonight's show is going to be, well, a little bit different than last time around. But tonight, for instance, we have Coming Back with Bigger Guns from the new album in the set. I don't quite remember what we had last year, right? Yeah. But a lot of it will be the same.
Well, so probably, at least you're opening this time, whereas last time it was Killer Dwarves and Kickaxe and yourself, mm-hmm. So you closed the show. So obviously when you're going, what, 45, 50 minutes tonight, I'm guessing, somewhere in that range?
Yeah, it's about a 50-minute set, 60 with encores.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I guess another question that I wanted to ask is, like, when you go out with these other Canadian bands, is that kind of a, like, is there somebody specific that's kind of running that, or is this you putting this together?
It's put together by the agent and promoters. Obviously, the promoter is the final say because they're, you know, they have skin in the game. And they're nuts on the line, you know, they have to sell, put bums in the seat. So, you know, the agents there try to put together the package for the promoter. Like Bernie Alvin is our agent. Bernie said to me many times, a good agent looks out for not only the band, but he looks out for the promoter as well, because, you know, common sense dictates that if you burn the promoter, he's just not going to have you back, and it's going to be bad for other bands of your genre down the line. So, he wants to put a band in there that's going to make money for the guy, right? And that way that you're going to come back, and it's good for everybody all the way around.
Now, how important is it to be Canadian, like a proud Canadian? Because when I hear you talking about certain things, I can sense that you have a pride of being Canadian, and you talk about all these other Canadian artists. And so I'm just interested, like, in being that, like, what does it mean to you to be that?
Well, it's funny, you know, I'm very proud of my country. We toured this country every nook and cranny across the country before we got signed. But I think we've always kind of sounded like an American band, to tell you the truth, because we were influenced by Canadian bands, or by American bands, sorry, I think far more than Canadian bands. Like, we were definitely in the, like, you know, I listened to April Wine. Guess Who was first, American Woman was first on my pop. But, you know, then we were in other bands like James Gang, a lot of English bands too, like Humble Pie, David Bowie, Rolling Stones, Joe Cocker. And ironically, I ended up meeting a lot of those bands over the years. I met Joe Cocker on his 40th birthday. Humble Pie we played with down in Windsor. We toured with Kiss. And so... I think that the pride in being Canadian comes from just the fact that we were out there playing all those little towns back in the early days through the bars. And as I said in my book, you know, we partied with the locals, we drank with the locals, we slept with the locals. So we soaked up all that, atmosphere of those little towns all across the country. And we had a much more eclectic viewpoint. Than say bands nowadays are stuck in that, say, London, Ontario, and they never get out of London, Ontario until they get a record deal, and suddenly they're, you know. And that's largely because of the death of the bar circuit in Canada, which, and the United States. Back when we started, it was the glory days for rock bands. You could go out there and never come home. Nowadays, bands play once a month, and they don't play for another month. So I don't know how they learned their chops.
Yeah.
And we were out there every night.
For sure. And I can only imagine, like, even just learning what it's like to be together as a
group. Well, that's another thing, too. We not only matured musically, but we matured as people. It was a very slow process. You know, you started off, you played the Northern Ontario Bar Circuit, and then they'd send you, you know, if you survived that, then they'd send you out to the East Coast. And, you know, you'd lose a few more members, right? And then send you out in Western Canada, which back in the day was a dream because actually had color TV in your room and a bathroom, you know. So it all happens very slowly, and we were able to mature into the position of, say, fame or whatever you want to call it. Nowadays, bands, they're like nobody's in the sun. You get thrust into the spotlight. they're playing like multiple dates in a row. They're losing their voices. They're freaking out. They're sleep deprived. They're doing drugs, and you know, it's not the same situation. And I think that's why you get a lot of, you know, people exploding on the when they're out there and having all sorts of problems with their bandmates and people and fans and press.
Well, yeah, and social media. I mean, all the pressure that
that's a whole people other are letting that kettle of fish.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So since you've been all across the country, this is actually something I asked Murray McLaughlin when we had a chance to interview him, but you've been all across Canada. What is it you think is kind of the defining characteristic, no matter what part of Canada you're in, that perhaps kind of binds the country, binds the people?
I think just the giving attitude of Canadians. I think that Canadians will give you the shirt off their back, most of them. It varies across the country, but essentially that's it. Canadians are very giving people. I think sometimes that works the other way too, right? You know, we don't speak up as often as we can. You know, myself, I've spoke up about different things, and, you know, I kind of get a lot of flack coming back because, oh, no, you're not supposed to do that. You're Canadian, right? You're not supposed to friggin' mouth off. But
don't say anything about Gene Simmons. Yeah.
Why'd you say that?
Just because I know there's a little history there. There's some people giving you some flack over some things you said, and you know.
Oh, no, I never said anything about Gene Simmons.
No, it wasn't Gene Simmons. No, I thought it was Gene Simmons.
No, in fact, I was doing the swear net with the Trailer Park Boys last summer, and Mike Smith must have asked me three times in the interview. He turned to me and goes, "So is it true that Gene Simmons is a fucking arsehole?" I wouldn't answer him, right? I get along fine with Gene on the road, and I talked to him quite a bit. Talked about his grandparents dying in Auschwitz, and went down to the studio, me and Fritz, when he was in California producing Black and Blue, and we shot a game pool together. So I got along fine with Gene. I had no problems with Gene Simmons. I think that... the only little run-in we had with Gene was about 2 days into the tour when we played with him in Europe. He got us in a room, right? And he goes, and he was giving a shit because he thought we were copying some of their onstage moves. He goes, "You know, no one wants another kiss," right? And it was being lectured by my grade two teacher. But for the most part, we got along really good with the guys from Kiss.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say there was any bumps in the road there at all.
Yeah, and I guess it's really important to get along with just as many people as you can.
Yeah, like, you know, no matter who we were out with, I think we got along with pretty much everybody. I can only think of one band. I can't remember the name of the band. It was Tank or something like that from Europe. And they wouldn't give us a sound check, so we ended up kicking out all the friggin' lights, but that was about it.
I never heard of them. So,
yeah. You know? That's right.
We totally know their name of the band wrong.
I have heard of a band called Tank, but the music industry, again, like just what an illustration of how hard it is to get anywhere when there's so many bands that, you know, it's...
Yeah, like, you know, we toured with Motorhead. We got along great with Lemmy, and we did two or three tours with Motorhead. Although I almost got in a fight with Brian Robinson. He was a dick. There was one guy, that's probably the one guy I never ever got along with.
It's funny, because actually I think there's a belief that a lot of the bands in the 80s were divas, you know? A lot of them were competing for stage time and not supporting each other, but it doesn't sound like that's the case.
No, it was. there was a lot of dicks out there.
It was, yeah.
But like, you know, we didn't let it get to us.
Yeah.
You know, we were usually the opening band, so it wasn't to anyone's, it wasn't to our advantage to, you know, go head to head against the headliner.
Well, I just wanted to ask you one last question. So how important is it to have Linda, you know, kind of with you and supporting you over your time in Helix?
Well, I think it's everything. You know, why would you be with someone that doesn't like what you do, no matter what business you're in?
Yeah.
But she's a pretty rock and roll person. You know, she was one of the original waitresses at the Hard Rock Cafe in London, England. In fact, if you go to the Hard Rock, you know, they wear all the buttons.
Yep.
That was my wife that started that.
You're kidding.
That's Linda crazy. Started that because back in the day, when they worked at the original Hard Rock Cafe, which was off Hyde Park in London, England, and back then, I think it was Alan Tigris owned it. I can't remember. He actually married Ringo's first wife, Maureen. And but they used to, for a year of service, they'd have a silversmith actually make up a pin. Mm. And then for year two and year three, and my wife's got those pins, by the way, they're worth a lot of money. And she served everybody from Tony Curtis, Joan Rivers, Telly Savalas, all the tennis stars. So she was a real rock and roll person. Like when Van Halen did their first tour, they were mobbed by fans so much, she said to Van Halen, because I guess it must have been at the Hard Rock, she said, look, I'm here during the day. Here's the keys for my apartment. Just go stay there, right? So she's got pictures of Van Halen at her apartment. Joe Lynn Turner used to go over there, and David Coverdale would always be phoning. And so she's a real rock and roll person like I am. She actually helped run the first Led Zeppelin fan club.
Wow.
Danced with Robert Plant. She's talked with Mick Jagger.
Sounds like her life's almost as interesting as yours.
Probably more so.
You know,
she knew all those people. She knew Lemmy really well.
Yeah.
Lemmy almost came to our wedding.
Wow.
But he was on tour. But we invited him.
Nice. That is awesome. Well, Brian Vollmer, thank you so much. And
do tell
everybody where to find the new album, especially, and just where to find you.
Well, Paris Records has released the Old School in the United States and Europe, and they distribute through Selected Hits, which is the Sam Phillips label, that family. In Canada, I'm selling it myself live at gigs and through the website, and that's about it.
Awesome.
So, if it catches on and stuff, maybe get a distribution can or something like that. But I really like Tom and Paris Records in the States because Tom was in Cherry Street. That's right. And so he's got a love of the music. That the problem with a lot of music nowadays, especially in radio, is people running radio are consultants. It's been taken out of the hand of the DJs. DJs are there because they love the music. They know the music. They have knowledge of the music. I always say, give radio back to the DJs. Tom Mathers, he knows how to work this type of music. And for instance, Tom said to me, he says, fuck conventional radio. He says, internet radio. He said, I'm going to get you to do 70 station IDs. He says, I guarantee if you do these station IDs, they'll play you. Maybe only once or twice, but they'll play it, right?
Right.
So, when the album was finished, I went and did the studio and did 70 station IDs for Tom. And he's got that magazine called Rock Nation, so he knows how to work this type of music. And he's got when you got the love of something, it'll always go further than when you're just doing it for a job.
That's right. That's for sure. There's no doubt about that.
For sure. Well, thanks once again. And, I hope everybody visits that website.
Thanks again.
I know there's signed copies of the new album on there, so we'll have to get
I'll get you a copy today.
You know what?
You
come to the show, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
You bet. So good luck with the show today.